Speaking on the program at this time is Brother James W. Boyd.
Continue tonight with some more of the figurative description in the book of Revelation about the destruction of those powers that chose to resist and suppress and persecute the Lord's early church. As we read about the destruction of wicked men, there are two things that I would like for us to keep in mind, because they both will be relevant to what we study in the latter part of 16 and 17. That when God persecutes, or when God punishes, I should say, the persecutors, He is doing that which is just. He has every right, and He is doing what is right, because they are receiving their just due. They have chosen to oppose God and to be murderous, to be vindictive, to be in heinous ways toward God's people. And so if God overlooked that and did not deal with that, He would hardly qualify as being a God of justice. But His wrath is poured out upon them. Another thing we need to remember is, and this will become more apparent in chapter 17, a principle that we often see exercised in the Old Testament, how that God will use those who are evil as His tool or instrument to bring judgment and justice and His wrath against others who are evil. He will use those who are evil to bring calamity upon other evil people. Not that those who He uses are justified themselves, but this is the way that God often works. He did that when Israel of old was wicked. He would use even heathen nations to humble Israel and to bring them to their knees. Now tonight we begin our study with the 8th verse of the 16th chapter, and we're in that series of the outpouring of the vials or bowls of God's wrath that are depicted here. There are going to be 7 in number. With verse 8 we have the outpouring of the 4th vial. The 4th angel poured out his vial upon the sun. Oft times the sun, as well as the moon and the stars, in figurative language like the book of Revelation, are representative of dignitaries and powers and those that are in authority. So God's wrath will be poured out upon the sun, and power is given unto him to scorch men with fire. And men were scorched with great heat, and blaspheme the name of God, which had power over these plagues. And this is a significant statement. And they repented not to give him glory. In the time of Israel in the Old Testament, we will recall that there were those occasions when God would allow evil men to punish them, to occupy them, maybe to carry them off into captivity. Israel would repent. God's chastisement against men is not just to even the score. It is not a vindictive attitude. It is not, I'm going to get even with you, I'm going to make you pay. That's not the idea. It's always with a higher motive involved in that, and that is that people might turn from the error of their way. God is not willing that any should perish. And even with the punishment upon the persecutors, His purpose would be, primarily, that they might repent of what they were doing. These particular people, like others whom we read in the Bible, were so hardened of heart and determined in their course of wickedness that even though they would suffer punishment, they would not repent. And of course, this is somewhat reminiscent of the time when the Israelites were trying to be led out of Egypt and the plagues came upon them. Then in the verse 10, and the fifth angel poured out his vial upon the seat of the beast. The beast now would refer to Rome, and the seat of the beast would be the one who sat in the highest authority of Rome, which would be the emperor's throne. And his kingdom was full of darkness. That's the way it's described. And they gnawed their tongues for pain. Obviously, great agony was going to come upon them. And blasphemed the God of heaven because of their pains and their sores, and repented not of their deeds. Though they were suffering, they would not change. Verse 12 is, to my mind, a very dramatic picture of the turning loose of God's wrath upon Israel. And he says, and the sixth angel poured out his vial upon the great river Euphrates. And the water thereof was dried up, that the way of the kings of the east might be prepared. Euphrates is the name of the river. It is a river that borders the northeast portion of land as one would come in from that direction into the land of Palestine. Because of terrain, because of the sea, because of the mountains, because of the desert, invading forces like Assyria, ancient Assyria, Babylon, Greece, Rome, they all would invade the land of Palestine, coming across the Euphrates River. During the time of flood stage, the people who lived in Palestine really had no particular fear of an invading force, because it would be very difficult for them to cross the river Euphrates. But here we spoke of how that the Euphrates would be dried up. That is, it would not be any longer a barrier to invading armies on the land of Palestine. And, of course, invading armies were soon to come upon the land of Palestine. These things were to shortly come to pass. And the invading army was going to be the Roman army. And it was this very pathway that they took. History shows to us that's the very way in which they came, as armies had done historically down through the years. That was the way they came to attack the inhabitants of Palestine. And so as God's wrath is poured out against those who were persecuting the church, the way would be made ready and prepared and opened to evil forces, to be sure, but evil forces that God would use to bring punishment against the persecutors. Now, at the end of verse 12, we have another intermission. This is very similar to what we've seen on other occasions when we were talking about the seven seals. We had six seals and then an intermission, then the seventh seal. And when we were talking about the seven trumpets, well, we had six trumpets and intermission and then the seventh trumpet. Well, here we're talking about the vials of God's wrath against the persecutors, and we see six of these bowls of wrath poured out and then an intermission, and then we'll get to the seventh one down in verse 17. And we had this interlude vision that is most strange. See if you don't think it's strange. Verse 13, and I saw three unclean spirits like frogs come out of the mouth of the dragon, and out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet. Now, in front of this figure, we know that these spirits, in verse 14 it tells us, the spirits of devils. But we know that these are evil powers. What can do the dragon? What can do the beast? What can do the false prophet? Well, the reference back to earlier descriptions and pictures that we've had in Revelation, we could conclude that the dragon here would refer to the emperor himself. The beast would refer to the empire over which he ruled. The false prophets would refer to any kind of false teachers. And the most prominent and destructive toward the Lord's church are false teachers in the first century. Were teachers with whom Paul was constantly in combat, teachers that we call Judaistic or Judaizing teachers, teachers that were trying to persuade particularly Jewish Christians to abandon Christianity and to go back to Judaism. Now, as to the use of spells, three unclean spirits come from the emperor and from the empire and from false teachers, and he says they're like frogs. I don't know why frogs were used. I don't have any particular thing against frogs. I don't particularly have anything for frogs. I've eaten frog legs. I'd rather have some Kentucky Colonel. I have had to cut up frogs in biology classes. That was sort of fun. And why frogs? Unless the coming of frogs against Egypt was one of the plagues. I know that. Is he just simply depicting here these spirits, these evil forces are like a plague? I'd put that in the form of a question because I don't know. Someone may have a suggestion as to why they are described to be like frogs. We know what they were. We probably can determine more precisely even who they were. That is, false teachers and the emperor and the empire and so forth. Why frogs? Whatever, that's the way it was described. And here's something else that's very difficult for me to even comprehend or understand or explain. For they are the spirits of them working miracles. Were they pretending to work miracles? Were they actually working miracles? Were they committed to work miracles? Or what is the significance? Was it literally working miracles? I don't know. I do know that miracles were performed, valid, legitimate miracles were performed in order to prove and to verify something. And sometimes there was deception, like a sorcerer who would profess or pretend to perform a miracle and would deceive. Maybe it's just speaking here that these evil spirits had the power of deception, like false teachers and oppressors and persecutors would often have. I don't really understand about these devils working miracles, unless they simply work miracles and just let it go at that, and I don't have to understand or explain how they were able to do it. Does the devil have the power to perform a miracle? Somebody? I know God does. You think these were pseudo miracles, deceptive sort of things, is where you. I'd like to think of it like that. Well, and people pretend to do what they don't do, maybe that's it. Yeah, that's deception. All right, there are evil powers that would be coming. They would obviously have certain power, whether it was legitimate or valid. And those folks would go forth into the kings of the earth and the whole world, and for what purpose? To gather them to the battle of that great day of God Almighty. Now, the emphasis here in this verse of a battle. We're going to read more about this battle when we get to chapter 19. It's just mentioned here. It is suggested further in verse 16 in just a moment. But here are the forces of the devil in operation. Behold, there cometh a thief. Blessed is he that watcheth and keepeth his garments, lest he walk naked and they see his shame. And he gathered them together in a place called in the Hebrew tongue Armageddon. How many of you have ever heard of the Battle of Armageddon? Anybody? Right now, everybody has heard of the Battle of Armageddon. Well, what is the Battle of Armageddon? Well, we'll find out for it, too. It is not a little carnal warfare. But premillennialists like to say it is. It's not the gathering of the forces of Russia against the Arabs or the Jews, as modern day prophets will say. The Battle of Armageddon is a figurative expression, a representative expression, like so many of the other symbols in the book of Revelation. Armageddon, and you can see it in the word Mageddon, is a derivative of the word Megiddo. Now, what's the significance of Megiddo? Megiddo was a very oft-used valley for battle in the land of Palestine. Israelite kings were killed in the battle of Megiddo. Israelites fought against the Egyptians in the valley of Megiddo. Megiddo was a place of that simply indicates a war. And it's used here symbolically for war. There will be a war. Not a literal war, not the shooting of atomic bombs and bows and arrows or anything in between, but a struggle. Now, the Apostle Paul writes to us Christians about not being in a carnal warfare, but a spiritual warfare. Here the forces of evil array themselves for battle. And that's the idea that is presented here. Not that there's going to be some kind of literal warfare at the end of time. Megiddo is a scene of conflict. And we're going to see later on that this battle that is under consideration here is the spiritual battle of good versus evil. Righteousness versus unrighteousness. God's forces versus the forces of the devil. And so there is this array of the devil's forces to plunge into this battle. In fact, at the time of this writing, and shortly come to pass, this battle was really going to be waged against the church, against the truth, in the effort and in the hope of being able, by the persecutors, to suppress it and stamp it out, stamp out Christianity. So we see these forces array themselves for battle. I'm trying to think of how we might parallel the idea. You've heard of people sometimes, of course, none of you ever experienced this, but you've known of families that have squabbles. Sometimes brother against brother, sister against sister, or brother against sister, or parent against child, so forth. And so, boy, they really got into it. It was a civil war. Well, it wasn't a civil war. They didn't have any armed forces, and there wasn't any Gettysburg or Battle of Chattanooga or anything like that. It wasn't a civil war. We know what that means, though, don't we? A civil war is where one part of the family is against another part of the family. That may not be a very good parallel, but that's sort of the way that this Megiddo is being used here. The battle is an Armageddon. It is a Megiddo scene. A real conflict. Now, with that little brief, rather confusing interlude, verse 17, we have the seventh vial. The seventh angel poured out his vial into the air. There came a great voice out of the temple of heaven and from the throne saying, "It is done." Now, of course, at the time of writing, it hadn't been done, but it's going to talk about things that will soon be done. But when it says, "It is done," is a statement of certainty. Here is something that was said, what was going to be done, and as the vision continues on, it is done. In other words, this outpouring of God's wrath upon the evildoer is certainly going to come to pass. You Christians, you can count on it. It will be, in time, a done matter. And so there was this thing, it is done. And there were voices and thunders and lightnings, and there was a great earthquake. Such as have not since men were upon the earth, so mighty an earthquake and so great destruction. And the great city was divided into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell, and great Babylon came in remembrance before God to give unto her the cup of the wine of the fierceness of his wrath. Here's a city, divided, cast down, called Babylon, the recipient of the wrath of God. This is not the first time that Jerusalem was referred to as Babylon. Jerusalem was under the domination of Rome. Jerusalem locally was under the domination of the Judaistic system, both of which were deadly foes of Christianity. Babylon had been an ancient enemy of God's people Israel. And Jerusalem was of such a nature that the Holy Spirit here said that Jerusalem is like Babylon, and so it's referred to as Babylon. And they are the ones that receive the fierce wrath of God. And verse 20 says, and every island fled away, and the mountains were not found. The islands and the mountains are other powers that would not come to the rescue of Jerusalem and of the Jews. They would have no allies that would come and to benefit them and to relieve them and to break the siege and the invasion of the armies that were to come against it. And there fell upon men a great hail out of heaven, every stone about the weight of a talent, and men blasphemed God because of the plague of hail, for the plague thereof was exceeding great. So this shows further the tremendous, awesome, destructive power of God that was coming against those who chose to be his enemies. That's the way I see it. And I hope that makes some reasonable, general sense to you. Anyone have any questions or comments you'd like to make concerning some of these things in chapter 16 before we really get into a difficult chapter? Of all the chapters of Revelation, at least to my mind, chapter 17 can be, in some ways, rather simplified, but in other ways is most confusing. I suppose, in the study of the variety of commentaries on the book of Revelation, this chapter, there's more disagreement about chapter 17 than any as to what it refers. We're going to read about a Babylon here. The disagreement is whether or not Babylon refers to Jerusalem or whether it refers to Rome. As I have said, I think it refers to Jerusalem because of the time element. That is, the destruction of Jerusalem followed shortly after the writing of the book. Whether you think the book was written before A.D. 70 or whether you think it was written, as some do, up to A.D. 96, the destruction of Rome was still a long way out. And we're going to see here the forecast of the destruction of this Babylon that is mentioned. Now, there are two creatures that are mentioned to us in this chapter. And I just want to frankly tell you, I don't have any biblical certainty as to how to identify these two creatures. One's called a harlot, the other's called a beast. As to what that refers, I rely almost entirely upon what secular history tells us actually happened. Keep in mind, and I have to repeat this, and I hope it doesn't become burdensome, that the things that were written in Revelation will shortly come to pass. We do not have God's revelation unto us specifically as to what these things meant, what it referred to, other than that he said it referred to what was going to soon happen. As we said, some of these symbols were used back in the Old Testament and probably had a similar meaning in the book of Revelation as they had back in the Old Testament. Those things we can speak with a greater degree of certainty. But as to what all of these things actually refer to, like the harlot and the beast, the only way we can determine what that is to study and learn what did happen. What actually took place. And try to see how what actually took place could be fitted into what is said here. Now, when you start doing that, you immediately must recognize you're involving yourself into a mammoth amount of speculation. Guesswork. Maybe so. Could be. And that's what I really run into in chapter 17. In fact, that's what I run into just about the whole book. But we do and can tell from historical records, not inspired records, but secular writings, what happened. So we're going to see something here that may not be it, but it does fit what happened. Okay? Well, these two creatures. There came one of the seven angels which had the seven vials and talked with me, John writing, saying unto me, come hither. I will show unto thee the judgment of the great whore that sitteth upon many waters, with whom the king of the world hath committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. This whore or harlot, of whom it speaks, I don't really know. But from, or whoever of whom it speaks, it was a source of wicked influence. Not only wicked itself, but having an evil and wicked influence upon many, many others. Now, in the way that I assign a meaning to this, I call the harlot Jerusalem. The forces of Jerusalem. I'll show you why in just a minute. And the beast, I'm going to keep calling Rome because he's been called, Rome has been called the beast several times. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon the scarlet colored beast, full of names and blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. Well, seven heads and ten horns is somewhat characteristic of the seven hills of Rome and the ten provinces of the Roman Empire. So that would probably refer to Rome, and this woman was sitting upon this beast. In other words, this harlot was being carried about, returned by, and taken in whichever direction this beast decided to go. Well, then that's what was happening to Jerusalem. The people of Jerusalem, the Judaistic system, being under the domination and occupation of the Roman Empire, it conformed to whatever Rome told it to do. And so the people of Jerusalem would have to be carried about, if you please, according to the will of the people and the authorities of Rome. Well, look at this verse. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet color, and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a cup, golden cup in her hand, full of abomination and filthiness of her fornication. She was a bad one. God looked upon them as evil. And upon her forehead was the name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots, and abomination of the earth. Doesn't it stand to reason? But if we have been correct in assigning the name Babylon to Jerusalem heretofore in the other chapters, that we would not shift gears, we would still continue to refer to Jerusalem as Babylon. So this harlot, this unfaithful one to God, and certainly the Jewish people have become unfaithful to God, have they not? How could they become more unfaithful to God than when Christ was, they were calling for his crucifixion, and we said, let his blood be upon us and for our children. And Pilate said, shall I crucify your king? And they say, we have no king but Caesar. It couldn't have been more unfaithful to God than they were. And therefore the term harlot and harlotry would certainly characterize them. God looked upon them as being abominable and filthy, and the source of so much of the apostasy from God. And this verse also further describes this woman in this fashion. I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints and the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered with great admiration. That is, she was awestruck. by her power, by her wickedness, by her presumptuousness, by her defiance. Wondered how in the world the people who were once people of God turned to be such people as they were. And this woman, Jerusalem, had certainly shed the blood of God's people down through the years. It certainly made martyrs of many of those who served the Christ. And so we see this picture of this harlot. And this harlot is under the subject to the direction of the beast. Well, we'll see some more about that. Verse 7. Well, you said unto me, wherefore didst thou marvel? I will tell thee the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carrieth her. See, the beast we hear about. Which hath the seven heads and ten horns? That's the beast, seven heads and ten horns. The beast, now, this I just don't even pretend to know. The beast that thou sawest was and is not. And shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. And they that dwell on the earth shall wonder whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world. When they behold the beast that was and is not and yet is. Any of you want to explain that to us? Why, clear as yours. About the only general statement that I would make concerning that verse is, this beast is an awesome power, a wicked power. It's straight out of hell, the bottomless pit. It's bound for perdition. It's a statement of its ultimate destruction. The idea of what was, and is not, and yet is, I don't know. Unless it could refer to some of the persecuting emperors from who were or had been, some that then existed, and even some that would still come. And that was certainly true. Maybe that's what it is. Well, let's look at verse 9. Here is the mind which hath wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. That would be Rome. And there are seven kings. Five are fallen, and one is, and the other is not yet come. And when he cometh, he must continue a short space. It is true that at the time the book of Revelation is written, if we be correct in our timing, five emperors of Rome had come and gone. One emperor of Rome was then on the throne. That was Nero, whose name matched the 666 that we talked about earlier. And there was yet awaiting in the future a persecutor of Christianity, Domitian, that was likened unto the viciousness of Nero. Now there was some intervening emperors in between Nero and Domitian, but none of those were really hideously persecutors of Christians like Domitian was. Domitian was emperor at the end of the first century, around 90 to 100. So maybe this refers to emperors who had come, and there was still one there. That was Nero, and there was still coming a persecutor who was just as bad as Nero further down the way. I don't know, but sort of figures a little. And the beast that was and is not, even he is the eighth. And he is of the seven that is to perdition. The ten horns which thou sawest are ten kings, which have received no kingdom as yet. Keep in mind, the Roman Empire is composed of ten provinces. Each of these provinces had rulers called kings. They did not have all authority. They were subject to the authority from the emperor. But they did have some authority. But they received power as kings one hour of the beast. For if I, for if they would grant unto them authority for whatever they would carry out, these various provinces, we would call them today satellites. Satellite countries. We got that, you know, during the Cold War, all of these little countries that were satellite countries of the Soviet Union.
Well, these provinces were like satellite countries. You had the big emperor up here, and then you had all these little kings down over here. And the emperor is the one that held the authority, but these kings would do what the authority told them to do. It says these had one mind and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. They surrendered everything to whatever the beast would want. And these shall make war with the Lamb. Now, the Lamb would obviously refer to Christ. For the persecution against Christianity was not going to be confined just into the city of Jerusalem or just in the city of Rome. It was going to be pervading throughout the entire Roman Empire. They will make war with the Lamb. But, now here's a good statement. And the Lamb shall overcome them. For he is the Lord of lords and the King of kings. Well, that's obviously Christ, because that's exactly what Paul calls him when he was writing Timothy. King of kings and Lord of lords. And they that are with him are called and chosen and faithful. Now, that's the ones that are the select and the elect and the favorable with God. And Christianity and Christ and Christianity would receive these persecutions against them from every source, in every province, from every authority, and yet the Lord would overcome. 15. He saith unto me, the waters which thou sawest where the whore sitteth are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues, the people from all over the world. And the 10 horns which thou sawest upon the beast, these all hate the whore, and shall make her desolate and naked, and shall eat her flesh and burn her with fire. Now, this is an important historical point. These provinces that were subject to the emperor's rule, who had some authority but was a subordinate and delegated authority, they would be persecutions of the church throughout all these provinces. But every one of these provinces hated the Jews. And they hated Jerusalem. And they would rejoice at the destruction of the city from which Jews had come. You keep in mind that Jews were now scattered throughout all the empire. There were synagogues everywhere. And whether it is God's punishment, or whether it was God's providence, or whether it's just coincidental, I prefer to think of it as God's providential punishment. Because of the choice of the Jews to reject Christ everywhere they had ever gone, they have been subject to the heel of the people, persecution of people. They are a harassed and a tortured race of people. Can anybody doubt that? Wherever you go, you talk about racial prejudice, the Jewish people historically have been the victims of it. I don't know about you, it's a little hard for me to want to be prejudiced against a Jew just because he's a Jew, because my Lord was a Jew. A lot of things about what a lot of people do that I don't like, but it's very dangerous to generalize about any race or group of people. I just hate it when people say, oh, you know how preachers are. I say, yeah, I know how some of them are, and I know how one is. I just don't like to be lumped in with just everybody that calls himself a preacher. Would you? I know how teachers are. I know how nursemen are. I know how businessmen are. Well, you don't lump everybody together like that and come up with the right conclusion. And you can't just lump all the Jews in a pile. Oh, you know how Jews are. Yeah, how are they? Well, you've got them this way and you've got them that way. I know how, you know how blacks are. Yeah, I know how some blacks are, but I also know how some other blacks are. You see, that's a very dangerous thing to do, just lump everybody in the same bucket, isn't it? But throughout the Roman Empire, they lumped all the Jews just about in the same bucket, and they were hated. They were despised. Now, maybe there was some justification for that, but they were hated and despised. Adolf Hitler and Nazi Germany hated Jews. Not this Jew, that Jew, for this cause, that cause, just because he was a Jew. He lumped them all in the same bucket. And that's not the right thing to do. But that's what Rome had done to the Jewish people. And they hated this whore harlot or Jerusalem. And when you went by, they were going to say this, Bonnie, not here now? You get plumb hauled off and forgotten your clock stop. Well, then that don't wait on me. I'll tell you, you better go ahead and let me put on the boat. Let me get these last two verses. For God has put in their hearts to fulfill his will and to agree and give their kingdom unto the beast, and the words of God shall be fulfilled. This is all God working on, all of this whole thing. God said, and the woman who sat there is that great city which reigneth over the kings of the earth. That's the only place that he's talking about, Jerusalem and Rome. And the ultimate, well, the immediate power they would exercise against the church, but the eventual punishment they would receive. And what is remarkable is that God used Rome, evil persecuting power, to crush the Jews, the other evil persecuting power. That's the way God oftentimes works. He uses the evil to punish the evil. Well, Lord willing, we'll begin with 18 next time. I'll be glad when we get to 19. From 19 to just about the rest of the book, it's positive, it's happy, it's celebration of victory. We've had so much blood and gory persecution, destruction and wrath and punishment. And when we get to 19, we're going to begin to see the bright side of all this for the Christian, the faithful Christian.